Chapter 14. Oxymorons. Alec had disappeared by the time Jody and Tyson untied me. Pulled away by kids whose faces I didn't see. "They're giving Alec what he deserves," Jody said. As soon as my arms were free, I felt all over my face and neck. Still expecting the telltale swelling that would come from a lethal bee sting, but I had been lucky. Now, the intense fear I had felt resolved into an aching headache, and a weary sense of mental vagueness, like I was watching this all from a distance, or maybe I just wished I was. I followed them from Alex's house, downhill, wishing I could go home, but not feeling strong enough to do anything but follow. "I'm not really a part of it," Tyson said, on the way, when Jody had gotten a few paces ahead and couldn't hear. "You've got to believe me."
"I believe you."
"I haven't done a thing. You've got to believe me."
"I believe you."
"She just told me today I wouldn't be caught dead wearing this hat if Jody and I weren't going out."
"You have to believe that."
"I believe it."
But apparently, Tyson had a harder time convincing himself that he didn't convincing me.
"Where did they take Alec?" I asked Jody. "Where do you think?" she said. I followed them to the ghosties and to the tugboat, still resting in the cradle at the edge of the seawall. I climbed up through the hole in the hull to find them all there, crowding the whole of the old boat. Not 7 or 8 kids, not a dozen, but 30, maybe even more. Kids from younger grades, maybe even a high schooler or two. All of them proudly wearing that terrible hat. It was late in the day now, and the weird upside-down attic space was lit by at least a dozen flashlights, aimed at odd angles, casting jagged shadows that made Frankensteins out of everyone's faces. And they all came to me when they saw me. "Hey, Jared," they said. "Good to see you." They put their hands up for high fives, and I didn't return them. I just clapped me on my shoulder, or back as I passed, heading toward the front of the boat where their new leader waited. It was Brett Whateley. "I knew you'd end up with us sooner or later," said Brett, crossing his arms proudly as he stood there toward the front, straddling the V-shaped hull. Moose and Giorgio was also there, lurking large in the shadows. As always, his hulking presence enhanced the bitter flavor of the situation. Behind Brett was a wooden post, supporting the deck above. Tied to a post was Alec, or what was left of him. Whatever they had done to him, they had done it quickly. His clothes were covered in mud, or at least I hoped it was mud. His face was swollen, bruised, and bleeding. I turned to Moose. "You were supposed to be his bodyguards," Moose raised his eyebrows.
"We were double agents."
"It was my idea," Brettley had to add. My head still pounding, my ears still buzzed with the memory of bees. All I wanted to do was crawl up into a ball in the corner and let all this be someone else's problem. But I couldn't. The sight of Alec, battered as he was, brought my senses back into focus, and my thoughts back into clarity. "What makes you think Alec won't tell who did this to him?"
"He won't tell," said Jody, "because he knows if he does, it will only get worse."
"Yeah," echoed Brett. "Alec has paid his debt to society. After today, if he doesn't bother us, we don't bother him." But somehow, I found that hard to believe.
"As you can see, this is bigger than you now, Jared," Brett said.
"No sense fighting it," added Jody, as she took her place beside Brett. So they were the ringleaders now, like Cheryl and I had been. But while Cheryl and I were fueled by the resentment, these two were fueled by hate. You could feel it radiating from them like an aura. You could smell it as strongly as skunk.
"Alec thought it was you doing all that stuff to him," Brett laughed. "He didn't have a clue."
"It was my hair in his soda," said Jason Belmont. "But I put it in," said J.J. Welsh, who worked the Ferris food concession.
"I gave him the skunk," Jody said. "But we put it in the minivan," said the Wrangley twins.
"I had some fun with lunar glue," said Angela Windham.
"I had some leftover penicillin," Wendy Georgeman said.
I looked around me. All of them were guilty, and they were proud of it.
Brett gloated.
"We were your last best defense against the scum of the universe."
I shook my head.
"Tommy Lee Jones, Men in Black. You still can't come up with an original line, Brett?"
Brett just shrugged.
"Keep dealing in hatred," I said, "and it'll bite you in the ass."
Still nothing.
"Our hatred is justified," he said.
"Justified hatred?"
"Oxymoron," I said.
That got a reaction from Brett.
"What did you call me?"
Jody grabbed him before he could lunge at me. It means two things that don't make sense together, like jumbo shrimp.
But I was also thinking of it the other way, because all that hatred was definitely keeping this pack of morons from getting enough oxygen to the brain. Unfortunately, they needed something more than just fresh air, but I didn't know what it was. I turned to Tyson. You're okay with all of this?
If his shoulders sank any low, they'd be dragging on the floor.
Not exactly.
I knew I should have been pissed at him, but I wasn't. Because I knew who he was, and what he'd come from. He had gone from being the neighborhood outcast to being accepted, and even dating the girl of his dreams. Today, he was being asked to sell his soul to keep his new station in life. I knew it was tearing him apart. Still, I noticed he had taken off his TSC hat.
I looked at Alec. I'm sure he heard all of this. Even with swollen eyes, I could see him watching. But when I approached him, he turned away, unable to look at me in the face. I knew what he was feeling now. Hatred for the others, and guilt for what he had done to me. It wasn't just his face that was screwed up. It was his soul now. Because he had been at the edge. He had tried to kill me. And the memory would be with him all his life. I went up to Alec. I didn't know what I felt for him. Disgust, pity, anger. But regardless of how I felt, I knew one thing was true, and I knew Alec needed to hear it.
I forgive you, I told him. He turned his head away, but I grabbed his chin and forced him to look at me.
Listen to me, you lousy SOB.
I understand why you did what you did.
I forgive you.
I let go of his face, and this time, he kept eye contact with me.
I'm sorry, he said weakly.
I nodded. Apology accepted. Then I turned toward Brett, speaking loudly enough so that everyone could hear.
This ends here.
I don't think so, said Brett. He was in his element now, the power going straight to that slab of meatloaf he called a brain. There were an awful lot of people in this town who needed to be taught a lesson, Jody chimed in.
We've got lists, added Moose.
Yeah, said Brett. Lots of them. And everyone on those lists is going to get what's coming to them. The chess girl came up behind me. It's a good thing, Jared. You'll see.
Yeah, added Tommy Nichols. People around here will start thinking twice before doing things that bug us.
Who made you judge and jury, I asked them all.
You did, Jared, answered Jody.
The whole thing was your idea, remember? That's why we trashed Green's place for you. That's why we saved you from Alec today. That's why we brought you here.
Hearing her say that heated my blood to a boil. I'd done some awful things, but I would not take blame for all of this. I may have started the Shadow Club, but it took all of them to breathe new life into it. I reasoned that if I still held my mysterious power over this club, now was the time to wield it. I went straight up to Brett.
I started the Shadow Club, and I ended it.
Take that stupid hat off your head. I reached up and swatted off the hat, and in turn, he hit me, knocking me across the boat. It rocked slightly in its cradle as I hit the side.
We don't really need you, he said.
He grabbed me again and threw me across to the other side of the boat. Everyone shifted out of the way of our fight.
Are you beginning to get the picture?
My answer was a punch to his jaw. It stunned him, but not enough. He grabbed me again and hurled me to the other side of the boat. That's when the world began to move.
Metal fatigue. That's what they call it when a piece of hardware gives way and something big comes tumbling down, usually taking a whole lot of lives with it. With all those kids jammed into the hull of the old tugboat, something was bound to give. I heard the wood creak, and somewhere a piece of metal snapped, falling to the ground with a metal clang. Then the rusted steel cradle that held the tugboat gave way. And with a crash of metal, the entire ship fell to one side. I've never been in an earthquake, but I imagine that's what it feels like, because 30 kids were hurled off their feet as the tugboat rocked to the right, then to the left, coming to rest. No one was screaming. People don't scream in a real emergency, not unless they have a good long time to think about what's going to happen to them. There were just a few gasps and groans as kids hit the bulkhead.
Funny thing about being in the hull of a ship that's tilted over on its side, you can't tell which way is down. It was strange enough with the floor tilting up like a V from the center, but now, the ship fallen over on its side, my equilibrium was thrown all off. When I tried to stand up, I fell over as if I was drunk. Everyone tried to gather themselves back together, wondering what had happened, but I already knew. The boat was resting in such a way that the hole in the bolt, the one we all climbed through, should have been flat against the concrete now, leaving no way to get out. But instead, there was light pouring through the hole. In fact, more light than before. "Nobody move," I shouted, and for an instant, everybody actually listened to me. We might have made it out had it not been for Brett. He was behind me, next to Alec, but he pushed me out of the way and made the beeline toward the hole in the hole, hurling kids out of the way in his panic to escape. When he finally reached the hole at the back of the boat, he jumped out and disappeared, falling like a paratrooper out of a plane. Then came his surprised distant yell, suddenly silenced by a splash that told me what I already suspected. When the boat cradle gave way and the tug had fallen out, the tug's back end had slid over the edge of the seawall. There was no telling how close the entire tug was to slipping off the ledge and into the sea. "Nobody move," I screamed, but Brett had already opened the door to panic. Now, having enough time to think about their predicament, kids began to scream and jump over one another, racing for that little hole. "Don't!" I yelled. "Don't you get it? We have to stay toward the front, or..." The boards creaked as the boat slid a little farther. Still, they were crowding the hole, dropping through, one by one, into the water of the marina, figuring it was better than being trapped in the boat. It was like 30 people trying to escape from an elevator that was about to plunge. I suppose I was in panic, too, because I froze, not knowing what to do. But the thing about this I will always remember is that Tyson had the presence of mind to see the whole picture. He grabbed me by the shoulders to get my attention. "Untie Alec," he said, looking me straight in the eye. His look said everything. It gave me the whole picture. And the picture was this. With everyone shifting the weight of the precariously balanced tug, nothing we could do would stop it from going over the edge, which meant that things were about to get a whole lot worse. If we didn't untie Alec now, it might be the last chance we got. And so, as the other kids crowded the hole, Tyson and I got behind Alec and worked the ropes. Luckily, for us, they weren't exactly seaman's knots. A little bit of tugging and they came undone. Alec didn't have much energy left, but he did dredge up enough to groan and complain at us all the while, still only seeing his own predicament and not the greater danger. Just about the instant the last knot came undone, and Alec pulled his hands and feet free. The boat listed more on its side, giving off that sickly creaking of wood. "Brace," I said, grabbing onto the post that Alec had been tied to. The light through the hole changed, and the world tilted, and gravity took over. My mind was filled with the strange, surreal sight of 20 kids floating weightless in the hollow hole of the hole. Time seemed to dilate for that horrible instant. Then everyone was smashed back down as the tug hit the water. I was torn from the post. My shoulder hit the rib of the hole, not hard enough to break, but hard enough to leave a deep bruise, assuming I survived to have a bruise. There was no light coming through the hole in the boat now, only water gushing in like a geyser. In seconds, the back end of the boat was filling up with the water. The only light now came from the various flashlights the kids had held, all of which were now scattered on the ground, aiming in random directions. I grabbed one and shone it into the faces scurrying up from the stern of the boat. How many kids could I count? How many had gotten out before the boat fell? What if somebody was knocked unconscious by the fall and was still down there in the stern? Or even worse, what if kids who were already out there in the water were hit by the falling tugboat? There was no way to know. A single ladder at the tugboat's widest point went up to the closest hatch, which I assumed led up to the main deck of the tug. "This way," I shouted, pointing the light at the ladder. When I shone the flashlight back at them, the water level was higher. The entire stern was underwater now. Those kids farthest away were treading water, and it was already beginning to pool around my feet, soaking through my sneakers. Then came that horrid creaking of wood again as the boat shifted from its side to center, forcing the stern to sink even deeper. The few kids that hadn't screamed yet were screaming now. The first kids reached the ladder and began scrambling up. "One at a time," I yelled. But of course, it was no use. When panic sets in, common sense is always the first casualty. They were on top of one another, tugging at each other, fighting to get up the ladder just as they had fought to get out of the hole before the boat fell. The first kid to the top of the ladder pushed on the hatch, but it didn't give. "It won't open," he screamed. "It's nailed shut. It's nailed shut and we're all going to drown." "Hit it again," I told him, "harder this time." When he hit it, the wood rattled enough for me to know that it wasn't nailed shut. It must have been locked above. But like everything else in this old vessel, the lock would have rusted into nothing after years of salty air. There were three kids up there now, all clinging to the edge of the ladder, pushing at the latch with their arms and with their shoulders. Finally, the hatch broke and flung open, letting in that wonderful light of day. The water was up to my knees now, and the flooding hole got dimmer and dimmer as more and more flashlights submerged and shorted out. Once it was open, those kids on the ladder didn't look back. They went out through the hole, and the rest began to follow. The water was up to my waist and rising fast. I could see it spilling in from in between the weak, rotted boards of the hole. And still, there were more than a dozen kids to get out. None of them looked at me as they passed. They just kept their eyes fixed on the ladder and freedom. All the while, Tyson stood next to me, one hand on the ladder, the other grabbing floundering kids, helping them to the ladder. The last to go was that chess team girl, and the one who had been so anxious for me to get back at Alec. "Checkmate," I wanted to say, but I didn't. Instead, I just pushed her up toward the ladder, and she grabbed the rungs. The water was up to my chest now, and that's when the cold really hit me. I could feel my muscles knotting, balling up in shock. I thought the ocean was cold in October when I had taken the plunge and saved Tyson, but that was nothing compared to this. When the others were gone, and Tyson and I were ready to go up the ladder, something occurred to me with a sense of dread that I was sinking faster than the ship. I hadn't seen Alec on the ladder. I told Tyson, and he hesitated for a second. The water rose past my armpits. "He must have gone up, right? We got everybody out. He must have gone up. One of us would have seen him." I wasted no time, and did a surface dive, swimming as far down as I could go in that sunken hole. But even with the flashlight, I couldn't see anything clearly in that murky water. I found nothing but loose timber, dead flashlights, hats. So many hats. Then my own flashlight shorted out, leaving me in darkness. I was at the end of my breath, and I realized I hadn't saved enough air to make it back to the ladder. With my chest aching and my head pounding, I swam forward. But when I got there, where I thought the ladder was, I came up bumping my head against a crossbeam, and I was still underwater. "The air is gone," I thought. "The boat is entirely underwater." How deep was the marina? How far down would the boat sink? And if I did find the hatch now, how far would I have to swim to reach the surface? 20 feet? 100? With my lungs ready to explode, I propelled myself forward, my head still bumping against wood. Then I finally surfaced into a pitch-black space, coughing, sputtering, gasping deep breaths of air. I tried to get my bearings. I had no idea where I was, but as my breathing came under control, I heard just to the right someone else breathing. "Alec? Leave me alone." His voice came through what must have been clenched teeth. I knew because I was clenching my teeth to keep from shivering my fillings out. Now, I had felt around enough to get a good idea where I was. We were in an air pocket at the very tip of the bow. "Come on, the hatch is only about 10 feet back," I told him. "We can make it easy." "Fine, you can go," Alec said. Now, considering the fact that I was freezing and scared out of my mind, I was in no mood to deal with a pouting 5-year-old, which was exactly how Alec sounded. "Alec! You want to know why we moved here?" Alec said. "You want to know why? Alec, this isn't really the time for some deep personal conversation, okay?" "It's because they hated me there, too. We moved here so I could get a fresh start in a place where all the other kids didn't hate me. Not everyone hates you, just half of everyone. I couldn't believe I was being dragged into this. Can't you just shut up long enough to save your own hide?" "I hope they all drown," he said. "Every last one of them." "No, you don't. And don't even think it. Because if any of them do drown, you'll never forgive yourself for thinking that. If they don't drown, maybe I should." There was a splash next to me. I felt something brush past me, and for a bizarre moment, my mind filled with the image of a shark. But instead, someone surfaced and began taking deep breaths. "Jared," said Tyson, struggling to clear the water from his lungs. "I felt you swim past me before. You missed the hatch."
Tell me something I don't know. I'm going to kill you for not teaching me how to swim underwater, Tyson said. I was going to get to it eventually, I told him. Alex here too. I moved over and bumped my head against the iron crossbeam that felt uneasily loose. So, are we just going to sit here and drown ourselves? Is that the plan? Tyson asked. Alex feeling sorry for himself, I informed Tyson. Says he wants to die. I could hear Tyson's teeth chattering now. He might get his wish. Just then, I felt the boat hit bottom, shifting again. The jolt shook loose the crossbeam. It came plunging down, clipping my shoulder. I heard Alec yelp as he was struck and forced under by the weight of the beam. Suddenly, the water that was just below my neck was up to my chin. Tyson, I called. I'm okay, he said, but Alec... Alec, I called. No answer. Alec! But my voice was silenced as the last of the air emptied from the air pocket, and the old tugboat shuddered as it finally gave up the ghost.